ethics can seem really dry and boring, but ethics is really discipleship. For a Christian, when we think about ethics, ethics is how do we live in this world? How has God called us to live in this world?
Welcome to the Ministry at Scale podcast. I'm your host, Chad Williams. Join us as we discuss trends, learn from experts, and share practical tips to help your ministry multiply its digital impact. Welcome to the Ministry at Scale podcast. I'm your host, Chad Williams. Today, we've got the privilege of talking with Jason Thacker. Jason is the author of two books. Both of them are on how a Christian should be interacting and thinking about technology. Jason is also the chair of research in technology ethics at the ERLC, which stands for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. So Jason, welcome to the podcast. And could you just start by telling us a little bit about your journey and how you grew to be engaged at the intersection of faith and technology?
Yeah, well, first, thank you for having me, Chad. Really a joy to be with you. For my role, it's kind of interesting. I kind of backed my way into this. This isn't something that I may have planned years ago, like many, but I studied theology. I was always really into technology growing up. My dad worked for a Fortune 500 tech company most of my life. And so I was always exposed to technology. We had the internet before basically anyone did in the very early 90s, just because my dad worked on the early internet with the local Air Force base and a lot of different kind of computer gadgets and things. And so he was always really into tech. So I grew comfortable around it. Mm-hmm. But fast forward, became a believer when I was 18 years old, understood the gospel for the very first time, even though I had been raised around and in the church. But at 18, became a believer, went off to college, and felt a tug on my heart to go into ministry. I didn't know exactly what that was. I thought maybe it was pastoring or church planting. So I ended up going on to seminary to do my Master of Divinity in theology, ethics, and philosophy. And while I was studying, I just grew to love God's word and wanted to apply God's word to a lot of the big pressing issues of the day, and still didn't know what was going on. So for some listeners who might not know exactly what the Lord's doing, he does have a plan. It just always makes sense to you in the moment. But kind of fast forwarding, my wife and I met and then married, that is, that's the better order. We moved to Nashville, Tennessee, where I went on staff with the ERLC in a communications role. And then through that, just started through with reading and interest in technology. I started reading some books, and the more I read them, I wanted to write about them because I was from a theological and kind of ethical perspective. And that's really where this love for technology, society, and ethics kind of grew and it blossomed. Was through my writing. The more I wrote, the more I was asked to write. And the more I was asked to write, the more I wrote. And kind of just this kind of cyclical cycle of ended up becoming, having an idea for a book about artificial intelligence. Had been studying it for a number of years and wanted to help equip the church to be thinking proactively about a lot of these big technology issues that can be kind of scary and overwhelming for some. Others can be really excited about them and not be thinking through a lot of the impact or the influence of these technologies on our life and how they're shaping us and discipling us every single day. And so that's really where I wanted to come in to provide kind of a theological and ethical perspective on these really big technology issues as we think through these, not only within the church, but also kind of broadly in society.
Yeah. You know, for some of our listeners out there who maybe still be trying to figure out what God has for them, I love the fact that you brought out when you started down your path, you didn't know where it was going to take. And I've got kids, and some of them are reaching the stage where they're like, you know, what college should I go to? And some of those, it's one of the things I tell them. I really don't, most people change careers 7 times in their life. And so I'd rather have you follow the passion of where God is leading you. He'll guide the path to where you end up, as long as you're following in obedience to just taking that next step. And so that's just a really good reminder for me personally on the other role that we both wear as parents and as fathers. You know, your role as the chair of research and technology ethics, you know, for somebody like myself, who I love to read, I love technology, and I have a passion to live biblically, know, for me, that sounds like a dream job. But just talk with us, just share with our listeners what your goals and vision is for that role and how you're empowering the church and the kingdom through that role.
Yeah, it's a fairly unique role. So part of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, we're the public policy arm of the Southern Baptist Convention, which basically means our job is to educate and equip the local church on some of the big pressing ethical and moral issues of the day, but also to advocate on behalf of the church on issues of life and marriage and sexuality and justice, of issues that we care about as believers. And we do that in the public square through our government relations, through state legislatures and such. But we also do that working, and part of what I do is even working with technology companies, advocating for these beliefs, helping to provide a faith or a religious perspective on issues ranging from content moderation all the way down to ethical applications of technology like AI. And so my role is fairly unique in the sense that my job is to not only produce resources for the church, so whether it's books, podcasts, articles, those type of things, but also I'm doing a fairly good bit of research. So I'm digging into some of the big issues, whether it's misinformation or deep fakes or conspiracy theories, and taking these issues and kind of applying a biblical or scriptural lens over them and think, how do we think through these things from a Christian ethical perspective? Because often I think when people hear about ethics, they immediately go to that course they really didn't want to take in college, or maybe later on in their workplace, they had to take like a workplace ethics or something like that through HR. And the ethics can seem really dry and boring, but ethics is really discipleship. For a Christian, when we think about ethics, ethics is, how do we live in this world? How has God called us to live in this world? And so when you take ethics and you intersect that with technology, it's how do we then take and use these tools that God has given us the ability to create, see the good and the bad, and apply them in an ethical and a God-honoring way. And so throughout all of my work, but specifically the book, The Age of AI, that came out with Zondervan, that book specifically is focused on this kind of big question of how are we to use technology wisely? More specifically, how do we use artificial intelligence wisely? And I think the Bible is really clear, kind of the ethical mandate for Christians, that what God has called us to do and to be as believers is to love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and strength, and also to love the love your neighbor as yourself. That kind of two-pronged, or they also call it the double love command, to love God and love neighbor, is the backbone of what it is Christian discipleship, but even more specifically of the Christian ethical tradition. And so how do we then use technology to love God and to also love our neighbor and recognize the value, dignity, and worth of every single human being? And it might sound easy or it might sound trite when you just kind of put it in that really simple term of love God or love your neighbor. But when you start to apply that to these really complex ethical situations or these really complex technological situations, it becomes challenging at times. And so thankfully, the Lord has guided me through this and led me to this place. And I love it. I get really energized about applying these really biblical principles to some of these really pressing technology issues, because they can be scary. They can be overwhelming, thinking of issues of work or privacy, issues of warfare, or issues of the family and our culture, and even into our churches, about how these technologies are shaping and forming us as people. That's really is where I love to be, kind of applying these biblical principles to a lot of these pressing technology issues of our day.
I'm really glad that you brought up your latest book, The Age of AI, Artificial Intelligence. And, you know, in your book, you make a case that technology is amoral, but it's not morally neutral. So that feels like a contradiction. So just talk to us about that premise.
Yeah, often when people talk about technology, a question I get asked all the time, well, is technology good or bad? That's what I want to know. I mean, in simplistic terms, is it good or is it bad? And I think that's the wrong question.
Yeah.
And the reason is because we want often, in kind of as human finite beings, we really want kind of a black or white situation. Is this good or this bad? In reality, with technology, is just a lot more complex than that. Technology, I say, is amoral in the book, because often we'll say, well, technology is good or it is bad. Mm-hmm. And I want us to pull away from that and say, well, technology in and of itself is not good or bad. it has no responsibility, moral accountability before God, like we do as his image bearers, about how we choose to use these tools. So it's amoral in that sense, but it's not neutral. Because if we're saying it's neutral, that it's just a tool that can be used for good or bad, we miss some of the dangerous effects of technology and how they shape and form us. And you think of even simple technologies like a doorbell camera that have become really, really popular as of late. You think, well, a doorbell camera is just a camera on my front door. People push it. It lets me know there's packages there. Isn't that a good piece of technology? Well, then think about how that technology could be abused. You see, even and lately, having networked cameras throughout neighborhoods where police can access those, and whether it's a violation of privacy where people, hackers hack into these things, or working with local police departments for safety and crime prevention in our neighborhoods. You think now we live in a surveillance neighborhood or a surveillance society where every move and everything we do is being tracked. I mean, every single night when I take the trash out, I get a notification. Somebody's at your front door because it's me walking out of the front door. But think of the moments of kind of personal reflection, or the facial expressions you might have when you walk in the door, or conversations you have in your front porch, or just people walking by your house. Our house is fairly close to the road. And so people walk by our house and our camera records them in walk around the neighborhood. So you think there's just a lot of complexity to this little tool that sits on our front porch that provides a lot of benefits for our family. Not only knowing packages are here when people are here, being able to talk to people if I'm not here. There's so many benefits to it, but there can also be these kind of subtle or underlying dangers. And then to even zoom out further than that, you think of the way that these things, one of the reasons we have doorbell technology is because packages started being delivered to our door. Well, packages started being delivered to our door. Does kind of this web of relations, you zoom out and you see, well, that happened because we had the rise of the internet and internet shopping. Well, that happened because of something else. And so it's part of this like larger web of relations. There's a famous philosopher named Martin Heidegger that some people may or may not be familiar with, but he's a really influential person within kind of philosophy, ethics, and technology. And that's how he talks about technology, is a web of relations. So often we think of just this little tool, this little gadget, this little iPod, iPad, or what have you, and forgetting that it's part of a larger ecosystem. And so as Christians, we can step back and realize that these tools are not moral in themselves, good or bad, but they're also not neutral, because they do shape and form us as people. And God has called us in his word to be shaped and formed by his word, to be conformed to the image of Christ, to be more like Jesus in every day. And so we kind of have this competing discipleship that happens with technology, where technology is shaping us all day, every day, even often within the church walls. We're seeing, we're getting notifications on our phones. So you see that kind of impact. Some listeners may be familiar with the documentary that came out last fall of 2020, The Social Dilemma, that kind of gave a lot of fear for people about how these technologies might be manipulating your emotions or shaping you and forming you. Well, that's why I say technology is not, it's amoral in that sense, that it's not moral in and of itself. But that doesn't mean it's neutral, because it is shaping and changing us as Christians, and really as the wider society.
Yeah. One of the books that I like to recommend to folks who are maybe in the technology space and the faith space is Neil Postman's Technopoly. And you know, he's not a Christian, but again, just helping us think about, I love what you use, the web of relationships, because I mean, he makes the case of when air conditioners came out, they changed how we communicated with our neighbors. Instead of sitting on the front porch, now we're going inside. And those subtle things that technology changes, that as consumers, as users, even as ministry professionals who are using this technology, I think what I hear you saying is, don't use it, but let's use it with the full knowledge of what the potential impact could be. And I think that's really healthy for us to be thinking about. You know, AI, artificial intelligence, it touches a lot of things today. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But how would you define and describe AI to our listeners out there?
Yeah, probably the most simple way is the way I did in the book and talking about it's non-biological intelligence. That seems kind of convoluted still, but when you break it down, what it essentially means is the ability of a computer to think or to do things that were typically reserved for human beings, meaning making a decision. So you think of a really simple way of that is like a Nest thermostat. So on our wall, just outside of this room, I have a little thermostat on the wall that changes the temperature based on it learns. It's a smart device. You think we have smart phones, we have smart gadgets, smart TVs, smart appliances. Now you're starting to realize how much AI you even have in this a single room, but even your larger home with all of these smart devices that are connected to the internet or the internet of things. Essentially what AI is, it's a really complex mathematical formula. I mean, it's simple math in some ways. That is the ability to make these type of decisions. So based on this, it makes this type of decision. So it knows my thermostat has learned that in the mornings, we like to cool our house down a little bit. And so naturally, it just after me changing it a couple times, it realizes, well, at about 6 or 7 a.m., they're going to want the temperature dropped a little bit. And or later in the day, we're going to change it and we're going to turn it up. Or at night, we want it a little bit warmer because we have some young boys in our house. I have two sons, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and they get cold at night. And so we just turn up the temperature a little bit. Well, after a while, my learning thermostat has now learned the ability to do that on its own. Does it do it perfectly? No. AI is not a perfect tool. It doesn't always make the right decision. But what it can do is it can automate certain things in our life. You see AI also used in speech recognition. I won't even say the magic words because listeners very well might have a device around them and my devices will probably light up. But you think of Siri or Alexa and a lot of those type of smart home, smart speaker, smart assistants. They're always listening. While that might strike fear into people, they also only listen or record when they hear their wake words. When you say that certain phrase that will wake them up that I won't say because naturally my phone will ding. But these devices then I can say, turn on the lights and it turns on a light or turn this off or change the temperature, lock the door. You have all of those type of abilities, even just within our home, that artificial intelligence is already being used. But what I think and what I try to do in the book is explain not only kind of the ubiquity of artificial intelligence in our society, because it's not just our homes, it's our cars, it's manufacturing, it's in our jobs, it's in national security. I mean, it's everywhere in our society, because I opened the book with a quote from Ray Kurzweil, who's kind of a famous computer scientist. He works at Google now, where he says that artificial intelligence, I'll paraphrase it, but basically all of these various systems that if they all of a sudden decided to wake up, kind of the Hollywood thriller of artificial intelligence robots waking up, if these systems decided to wake up and either stop working or revolt against us, everything in our society would fall apart. And that might sound overly dramatic, but what he means is our communication systems are built on the back of some form of artificial intelligence. Our banking, economics, our manufacturing, our national security, there's kind of a baked in form of some type of artificial intelligence. And these range in complexity and application. But I think often we think of AI as some far off kind of phenomenon, some far off technology about the kind of killer robots or whatever, what have you, the red-eyed robots come to steal our jobs. And there are questions we need to talk about, the impact of artificial intelligence on our work or on our security or the role in warfare. But I think we often forget that we're using AI every single day, even if we don't realize it. And so one of the reasons I wanted to write this book on AI was specifically to say, you're already using it. So let's try to understand it. Let's try to understand why and how these tools work, but then also kind of the ways that they're shaping and forming us for good and for bad. Because again, as I said in the book, technology is a tool. Like we talked about earlier, it is a tool, but God has given us the creative abilities to make these tools, to use these tools. So it's our job to how do we capture these tools and how do we utilize them ultimately to love God and love our neighbor as Christians? That's what we're called to do. So then let's think through how that plays out, not only in our as we view ourselves as individuals, our families, our work, issues of data and privacy, warfare, issues of kind of work and automation, and even getting into some of the big kind of existential questions of the future of AI and where we're heading as a society and what's possible and what's not. That's what I hope to do, is give kind of a general introduction to a lot of these topics throughout the book and help equip the church more broadly to engage these pressing issues so that we're not playing defense in 5 or 10 years where kind of culture has moved on in some sense. And we're saying, oh, whoa, 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 we need to slow down a little bit because of X, Y, and Z. Let's be part of those conversations as they're happening instead of playing catch up to a lot of these cultural issues like the church, you know, honestly has done for a number of years now, even a century or more, is that we often have to play defense against kind of the cultural movements rather than being part of the conversation as they're happening.
That is fantastic. In fact, you just answered my next 3 or 4 questions. So that's excellent. But as you're having those conversations on the culture side, like, how have you been able to impact and kind of where are you seeing Christians, or maybe even we need more Christians at the table, having those influential conversations with folks that are actually rolling this technology out and making it available to folks?
Yeah, one of the things that's been incredibly encouraging over the last 5 or 6 years is meeting faithful believers who are working in these fields. Often they feel alone because there might be 1 or 2 believers and an entire workforce, or it might be more than that, depending on the size of the company. But often they're working in these technologies and they are wanting to be equipped to apply God's word to their work, just like anybody else does. We want to understand how to live faithfully for God and what God has called us to do. And thankfully, God has called a lot of really talented and thoughtful people to work in these fields. But that's something the church can also aid, is to say, hey, if you have an interest in technology, or if you feel that you might want to work in these fields, that can be your ministry. Often people, I think we think ministry means vocational ministry. Well, God has called us to a life of ministry. It's called us to a way of living in this world, of representing him, ultimately, again, to love God and love our neighbor. So thus the question isn't, well, do I go into full-time ministry vocationally or not? You know, for me, that was a big question I struggled with throughout college and throughout seminary. What was God calling me to do? But God had wired me a little different. Instead of being a pastor or elder in the local church, I still want to serve in leadership. I love my local church, but God has equipped me uniquely to step into some of these complex ethical and technological questions and issues that our neighbors are facing. And so one of the things that's been encouraging is meeting fellow believers working in these fields. I'm the first to admit I'm not a technologist. I'm not a developer. I'm not a coder. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm an ethicist. That's what God's called me to do and uniquely wired me to do. And so coming in to assist people and maybe put language to questions or issues that they're facing and struggling with as Christians in the workforce, but also being able to represent what we believe the Bible teaches about the good life, about how God has called us to live and to love him and to love our neighbor with non-Christians. And so in many ways, it can be a mission field as well, stepping into a lot of these questions, because the reality is that people in our society, especially those who are working in the technology industry, are facing really tough questions. Mm-hmm. It's often easy to kind of characterize, you know, they have it all figured out. They know exactly where they're going. Well, often there's these big questions about, you know, should we implement this tool or this feature? How is that going to impact or influence people? How is that going to change public perception? Or you get into questions of like social media and how these things are influencing and shaping our society. Even over the last 6 or 8 months, we've seen kind of the way that social media can shape the way that we think about the world. And more importantly, how we think about our neighbor, who God has called us to love, even if we have political differences or social and economic differences with them about policy issues, we're still called to love them as we love ourselves. But often technology can depersonalize, or in many ways dehumanize, our fellow neighbor, where we treat other people as simply an avatar or a bit of data. But God calls us to something much larger, is to recognize that every single human being is created in God's image. Every single human being created in his image also has infinite value, dignity, and worth, no matter their status, no matter their location, no matter their belief, the color of their skin. They're created in God's image. So then our question is not, well, should we do this technology even if it hurts people? Well, let's think about this a little bit more, because ultimately it's not about pursuing innovation for innovation's sake. Mm-hmm. It's about pursuing innovation and upholding the dignity and value and worth of every single human being and creating a better society, ultimately under God's reign and rule. And so I've noticed that in the technology field, these are the questions that people are asking.
Yeah.
So as Christians, we can step in and say, this is how my faith informs how I would answer this question or how I would approach this or the complexity of this given situation. And I think that's really valuable because it can really help us to navigate these things better as a society, as a very diverse and in many ways pluralistic society. Mm-hmm. We can approach these things better together than if we just all split into kind of these individual echo chambers and start treating each other as they're simply avatars or simply pieces of data. When we start recapturing that understanding of human dignity, and as we explore a lot of these technologies and the way they influence our society, we can ultimately kind of live up to the standard that God's called us to love God ultimately and to love our neighbors ourselves.
I know when I worked inside of a ministry, that was one thing that I said many times to the folks that would hear these big numbers about how many hits or visitors are coming to the website. Just realize every single one of those visits represents a person, mm-hmm. a human that's on the other side of that screen that we have an opportunity to minister to in a way that like radio and television did years ago. We're able to minister to them in the new age of technology.
And, exactly.
Yeah. Back on the AI, specifically on the AI side of things, a lot of our audience are directors or leaders inside of ministries who are wanting to make an impact in the ministry and the digital space. So how should a ministry specifically be thinking about and how to use and think about AI for the kingdom?
Yeah. I think often a lot of times behind a lot of our social media or digital marketing is some form of artificial intelligence or an algorithm, mm-hmm. As another way to talk about it. And so I think for us, it's understanding the way that these systems work. So often we think, oh, I can just micro target. I can do all these different things. Or if I word this ad a very specific way, I can have a higher engagement. And all of those things are good. We can use those things to reach people, ultimately to reach them for Christ, but also reaching them with resources and different types of ministry and loving people. But sometimes we're tempted to put the metrics and these analytics above the good of our neighbor. We think, well, if I get a higher engagement or if I get a lower cost per acquisition or I get higher clicks because I did X, Y, and Z, we have to sometimes step back and say, is what I'm doing good? Is it righteous? Yeah. Is it holy? Because if I'm manipulating people, and not that ministries would ever do this intentionally, I hope, mm-hmm. We don't want to be even have a sin. Like God calls us to be above reproach in every single aspect of our life. And so it's tempting to say, well, I'm going to put that return on investment, or I'm going to put that engagement or that email sign up or whatever, and kind of value that more than equipping people. And so it's not something that I think radically alters what we do and the ways it's really about the ways that we go about these things. What's our ultimate goal here? Is our ministry just to grow larger? Is it to have more money? Is it to have more influence? Is it to produce more resources or have more emails or more clicks or higher engagement? Or is it to love people?
Yeah.
And a lot of those things that we talked about are actually going to come along with loving people because we want to reach people. It's becoming incredibly difficult, even in a very connected society, to actually connect with people because our attention spans are so small. We barely, like, social media is intentionally designed to even like a Twitter of like, it's almost like a slot machine. You scroll, you get up to the top and you pull down and it spins for a second and then it drops some new stuff on you. And so one of the things that the way that we can step back as marketers or digital analytics and data folks is when we're thinking through a lot of these technologies and tools is understanding how they work. Mm-hmm. How are these designed? How are these algorithms? Because not everything, I think some people forget that just because you post it online doesn't mean that everyone sees it. So naturally you kind of alter your text or alter your image, or you put it out at a certain time, or you have a sponsored ad where you're paying to have that put in front of people. And none of those things are bad in and of themselves. But I think when we lose sight of what our ultimate goal is and get kind of bogged down in the numbers and the analytics and wanting to have certain returns and X, Y, and Z, we forget what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so kind of recasting that of loving God and loving our neighbor, because a while ago I wrote an article called "Is Marketing Moral?" Because there was a book that I think is a really helpful book for listeners to grab. It's incredibly long and dense, so I'm not arguing that it's an easy read, but it's an incredibly important read. It's called "The Age of Surveillance Capitalism." A Harvard professor named Shoshana Zuboff, Z-U-B-O-F-F, Shoshana Zuboff wrote about the way that we kind of live in a surveillance society. She talked a lot about the role of social media, how these technologies are formed and created in order to kind of shape and in many ways emotionally manipulate people into doing whatever we want. And so I think that is a really helpful resource for folks to grab and to think through, because what it can do is it can kind of help to shine a light on the darkness that kind of surrounds a lot of these technologies and help us to understand. Now, I don't agree with all of her premises or policy advisements and things like that, but I think she helps to kind of tear down the wall and help us to see around and see what's actually going on. It's almost like putting on a new lens and understanding better the world around us. And by doing that, then we can apply God's word and God's principles of loving God and loving our neighbor to these really important technologies, and just utilizing them with that ultimate end in mind of loving God and loving our neighbor, rather than just pursuing innovation for innovation's sake or getting in the black at the end of the year. Those things are not bad in themselves, but when they become the ultimate, that's where it becomes really dangerous from a Christian perspective.
That is excellent. Just so our listeners know, we'll be capturing all the resources that you're recommending. So they'll be in the show notes so folks can go and check out the books and other resources. I love what you've said, that, you know, there's the practical side of communicating and being able to, like, one of the questions we ask is, well, how are we going to measure success for this? But then there's the ministry side. And I've seen ministries be on two ends of the spectrum. One end would be, well, we're never going to ask for money, or we're never going to, we never want to use the word marketing inside of our ministry. But they'll use words like communication and others, to the complete other extent, which you were addressing, which is people are leading with what is the latest, the flashiest, how can I get people to my website? How can I get people to engage on social media? And not thinking about either what is our purpose and how our methods may actually run against the purpose of what we want to do in ministry. And what I've always encouraged ministries to do is, if you lead with ministry, if you lead with your heart, the money, the resources, and the results will follow. But yeah, you have to, it's not an either or, it's really a both and which one is priority.
And yeah, I think one of the most important questions that we can ask in this age of AI or this digital age is not can we, but should we?
Yeah,
that's the ethical component. And so as ministries, when we're approaching these things, is not just can we do this, because honestly, you can do a lot of things, but doesn't mean that it's always wise, beneficial, or good, especially if you're kind of keeping the idea of human dignity at the center of these questions that you're asking, is should we? Should we do this? It's not can we, it's again, should we? And that's really the ethical component that I think we need to apply to a lot of these really big pressing questions in this digital age.
And there isn't always a clear answer to that question. Exactly. I mean, one believer can choose that, yes, we should. Another believer in another ministry can choose a different direction, and they can both be right, depending on their perspective. And that's, I think of Romans 14 and learning to live with each other with understanding and with grace and not looking down, but at the same time, not just adopting another person's stance just because the other person takes that stance. And we want to be thoughtful and intentional. You know, one of the areas where we're seeing is the role and influence of big tech companies has undeniably, it's been growing. And we saw several of them exercise that influence in the last month. This is being recorded in February and January in the aftermath of the election, shutting down certain voices or platforms like Parler. How should Christian ministries think about that specific development, both from a how should we think about that, both from a risk mitigation standpoint and from a how and what are we communicating in the culture and what would happen if we were to be a target of that influence?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful. I mean, there are some really pressing questions that need to be answered in our society. And this isn't just for Christian ministries. This is kind of society-wide. These are a lot of the questions that social media companies are facing and they're questioning and wondering or trying to make decisions, really difficult decisions. Because I think it's easy, especially for those of us maybe on the receiving end of some of bad content moderation policies or ways that we're really concerned about our voice or our message being censored or shut down by the power and kind of the influence of these technology companies. It's tempting to forget that the people on the other side are people just like me and you. They're having to face, I think, and specifically with content moderation, we think, well, you know, I might tweet something that may or may not have violated a policy on Twitter. Well, if my tweet gets flagged and has to go for a review, it's really frustrating for me and it kind of shuts something down or my account got suspended. And there, you might be right and they might have done the wrong thing and you should be able to appeal and to advocate for that. But it's often tempting to see that in this isolated individualistic type of terms of saying, well, they did this to me and that's really frustrating. But forgetting that these social media companies go through millions and millions and millions of posts every day, not every week. They're having millions of pieces of content come across their platforms. And a lot of times when things are flagged on social media as violating policies or what have you, they're often done initially by an AI system. Fancy that. I mean, we've been talking about AI this whole time. Well, artificial intelligence is helping these companies to filter out very, very dangerous and vile and evil content on these platforms that you never see. Things like terrible, terrible hate speech, terrible violence, child pornography. I mean, dangerous and just wicked things are almost immediately taken down. Most social media companies, most listeners may not know this exactly, but a lot of these social media companies, depending on their, regardless in many ways of their policies on pornography, each of these platforms kind of have a different way they approach it. Instagram and Facebook, by and large, just kind of completely ban nudity. Other platforms like Twitter and even Parler had a lot of pornography on them. But none of these platforms have a large swath of child pornography. Well, how is that possible? Because we know that our society is broken, that there are many people who peddle and work in these industries, sex trafficking, child trafficking, who are posting this stuff online. Well, they have an artificial intelligence system that's smart enough, who by and large always makes the right decision by taking and removing this content even before it's posted. It immediately says, this cannot be posted on our platform. Well, sometimes it's going to get it wrong. It's going to get something wrong. There's going to be something that was misinterpreted. There's going to be some issue that the system didn't know about. And so you have an appeals process where you're able to appeal to like a human moderator. But when we forget that out of those millions of pieces of content, a human moderator still might have thousands and thousands of pieces of content to get through in a single workday. And they're seeing some of those vile and hateful and evil things and saying, yeah, that was right. Yep, that was right. That should have been removed. And they're having to see these things over and over and over again. And they get tired. They get cranky. They get angry. They get depressed. They get overwhelmed. And so often, even in that situation, we can say, well, I can't believe that person thought that this was wrong. Well, maybe they made a mistake. And so we should be able to have these appeals process. But if you zoom out from that specific kind of understanding of what's really taking place in, let's say, content moderation, when you step out from that, you realize that maybe these companies have bad policies. They're wrong. I don't agree specifically with the way that Twitter, their hateful conduct policy. I think it's overly broad. I wrote an article just a few weeks ago on Twitter's hateful conduct policy, and I think it's really dangerous. I think that the way that they argue that any type of issues surrounding sexuality, marriage, specifically with issues of transgenderism, if you identify someone by the wrong pronoun or you misgender them, or I didn't know this until the last few weeks, something called dead naming, where you use a name for someone prior to their transition to this new gender from a man to a woman, they say, well, that's my old name. And if you use that old name, it actually violates this hate speech policy at Twitter. Well, that means your post can come down. Now, does Twitter have the right to have and create these their own policies? Yes, they're not a government organization. They have the ability to create the policies as they see fit. But we as a public also have the right and the ability to advocate for better policies, to say that these policies are dangerous or overly broad or ill-defined. And so when we step into those conversations, we should be able to advocate to be able to promote biblical ideas of marriage and sexuality that are not just biblical ideas. They're scientific realities about how God has created this world and created us in his image. And so we can advocate for better policies. And there are a lot of different ways that you can go about this. Should the government get involved? Should the government not get involved? Should these companies have rules and regulations? Should they not? What role should the public have? There's a lot of complex questions here that need to be addressed by a thoughtful church. But I think it's easy in these situations to forget kind of the complexity and also to forget the large kind of nature of what's actually taking place here and just focus on that very specific issue of saying, well, I'm being censored. Well, maybe you are, but maybe you're not. Maybe it was just an honest mistake. Maybe it was an AI that made a mistake. Maybe it labeled something incorrectly. Maybe a human reviewer made a mistake. And so I think for us as Christians in a digital age, when we're engaging a lot of these really complex and kind of overwhelming, if we're honest, questions about social media and content moderation and policies and all of these things, we need to be able to step back and do two things. One, we don't need to panic. This world is not our home. The way these technologies, we may one day not have them, and that's okay too. I was talking to a friend the other day and they said, well, you seem really hopeful about all of this and it seems pretty dire situation. I said, well, I do. And the reason is because I know the end of the story. This is what I write about in the my book on AI is I know the end of the story. So I don't have to fear technology. I don't have to fear society because my God is reigning and ruling. He's sitting on his throne. The end of the story is written. He's already raised from the dead. So it's not that I have to fear the future as much as I can engage the present with that hope and that peace and that steadfastness and approaching these situations that are really important. We have really important debates that we need to have as a society. But even more so than that is going back to that kind of ethical principle of loving God and loving our neighbor. Our enemies, we think are political enemies or social enemies or these companies, we can treat other people as if they're our enemies. But the scriptures in the New Testament are really clear that we don't fight against flesh and blood. Our enemies are not one another. Our enemies are the principalities and powers of evil that ultimately are the kingdom of darkness, the Satan himself, the devil himself. That is our enemy. Yeah. So when we engage with our fellow brothers and sisters, when we engage even within the local church, but when you get outside of the local church with other human beings made in the image of God, we can be grace-filled, loving people, even if we disagree. It's a concept that my boss here at the ERLC talks a lot about called convictional kindness. We're convictional. We have truths. We believe these truths. They're unchanging. This is what God has called us to. This is what he's called our society to. But we also do it in kindness. We're loving. We care about the other person. We don't just treat them as an avatar. We don't just treat them as a little bit of data. We treat them as a fellow image bearer with infinite value, worth, and dignity. Understanding that not only may they be in sin, but we also are in sin. We are sinners before a holy God. We're not perfect. And so kind of having that eternal perspective and that understanding of human dignity can help us to approach a lot of these really difficult questions with grace, with humility, with peace and hope, but also with conviction and with truth, speaking the truth, but doing it in a loving and kind way.
What you just did there at the start of what you're sharing did something that I haven't seen anybody do on this topic of big tech, and that is you took what we were just talking about, that there is a human behind the computer, there is a human behind this, and you did an incredible job of humanizing and realizing that there's real people that we're interacting with, and that they're not the enemy, but there's principalities in the things, and so we want to engage with them. I really appreciate that. That's even helped my perspective as I've been thinking through how do we advise and recommend to Christian ministries how they should be thinking about risk mitigation and some of those things.
And there's a really helpful resource called Ghost Work. I forget the author. It's called Ghost Work. And I'm not fully recommending every single thing in the book or all the stories. It's kind of dark at times. But it gets in behind and it humanizes a lot of the, they call it ghost work, which is behind the scenes that we just assume like an AI or an algorithm is doing, but there's actually thousands of human beings reviewing these types of content, training these systems. Yep. And it goes into kind of the human element behind a lot of these quote unquote automated decisions in our world. And it helps us to understand that not only are these complex and important questions that we really need to engage and debate on, but there's a human being often behind them who have their own struggles, their own doubts, their own fears, and even some of them who are dealing with PTSD because of the amount of violent content they have to be exposed to every single day. And so I think as Christians, we need to not approach these things simplistically, but understanding kind of that broader kind of complex nature of these questions and these issues. Because ultimately this comes down to, again, and I hate to keep saying it, but it is the core of how we approach these things is how do we love God and how do we love our neighbor? That is the two questions that we have to keep central in our pursuit of technology and innovation, because without those, we forget what the ultimate goal is. We forget what the ultimate end is, which is ultimately, again, to love God and love our neighbor.
Do you have any practical suggestions for a ministry who may be writing about content that is controversial today? And you've already named off a number of those topics. A ministry that might be writing about those who may want to put some risk mitigation thinking in case they were to become a target of big tech. What practical suggestions would you have for them?
I think first and foremost is reading the policies. I think it's a simple, it kind of seems like a trite answer of just understanding the policies. But I think often they call it click wrap. It's a way that anytime you open up like a new program or you have a new download, you see that really long terms and conditions. And I'm not arguing it's easy to read these things. They're intentionally written to be at times overly convoluted and overly difficult and almost unintelligible unless you have a law degree to understand what's actually happening. And we scroll to the bottom as fast as we can to hit accept, check, I understand, I've read the terms and conditions. We've never read the terms and conditions, none of us. I think I read a while back that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States admitted that he doesn't even read the terms and conditions. And if the chief, you know, judicial appointment or appointee in the nation doesn't actually read them and doesn't actually understand them, then there's no hope for the rest of us. Yeah. But I think when we approach issues of social media, let's understand the content moderation policy. Let's understand the rules that these companies have set for their own platforms. Because often if we encounter a situation where a post was taken down or we were censored or our account was suspended or there was some kind of issue where even in our own ministry, it's hard to get ads approved at times for various platforms, especially on Facebook, because the nature of the things we're talking about, Facebook has a broader definition of what it means to be political. So a political ad is really a social ad. We don't advocate against or for a specific candidate because we don't feel like that's what God's called us to do, is we talk about the issues. Well, when we talk about the issues, these things can be automatically labeled as political. Well, you understand the environment you're working in. You're understanding the policies. And I'm not saying we do that to skirt around these policies or anything like that, but you kind of understand the way these companies have set their platforms up to work. And so I think that's one of the best ways you can do it. And a lot of times these, whether Twitter rules or Facebook's community standards or Instagram's community standards, they're written by lawyers, but they're not overly difficult to understand. You can kind of scroll through them and see them. And you very well and probably will, as a believer, have very strong disagreements on some of those policies. But helping understanding what the rules of the road are and the rules to use these platforms, I think can go a long way for a more fruitful and beneficial ministry, because we've been able to get digital ads approved by understanding certain language that they're going to flag automatically. So we rewrite our language so that we, not to get around the policy, but so that we can share a resource with someone and talk about a really important issue and help equip people on it. So I think that's one of the most practical things, is just reading the rules, reading these community standards and understanding them, but also advocating on behalf of them, whether it's through your writing, through your publications, through reaching out to these companies. Often they have community representatives, or they have various representatives for different constituencies within our nation and society, is reaching out and working with them. But again, I think one of the best ways that we can model Christ's love in a really complex digital society is not to panic. We often want, we default to, if something happens and it doesn't go the way we want, we panic, we get frustrated, we, you know, rage tweet, a rage post. Well, in a society that prioritizes speed and efficiency, which isn't good for the human soul, of always consuming and going faster and faster and faster and faster, sometimes the best thing you can do is log off. Sometimes the best thing you can do is draft that post and save it, or, you know, rage tweet it and delete it. Because how are we representing Christ in our interactions online? And this isn't just for marketers. This isn't just for organizations. This is for individuals. It's easy to respond with a real sassy or sarcastic or a put down on someone on social media, rather than slowing down, stopping, taking a breath, walking away, and coming back and saying, okay, I was wronged, but I don't have to wrong someone to remedy my wrong. I don't have to have the right thing happen, as it isn't two wrongs, like my grandmother always told me, two wrongs don't make a right. So just because we were wrong doesn't mean we have to wrong someone to make up for that. And so I think that's really helpful for us to slow down and, you know, grab a book. I mean, I'm not recommending just my own specific book. There are a lot of books out there that talking about this. I have a forthcoming book that I'm starting to work on discernment in the digital age, kind of pursuing wisdom, especially in light of conspiracy theories or misinformation, a lot of those kind of big kind of social issues that we're facing right now. Pick up a book. There's a lot of them that are really, really helpful to kind of help you understand. And that is an intentionality that you have of slowing down. Books are harder and longer to consume than a whole bunch of tweets or a bunch of Facebook posts. And so that can help us to gain a better and more grace-filled perspective when we approach a lot of these really important questions.
Yeah, on that topic, there's a quote that I share with my kids and our staff. It says it's better to do right than to be right. And that's helped guided my thinking in a lot of areas when I'm so tempted to respond in like ways and realize, no, you know, I can do the right thing here, even if I feel like I can do the right thing towards another person, even if that means not even making a defense for my actions. Jason, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate the mindfulness and the thoughtfulness that you're intentionally bringing to the conversations around technology and faith, and just bringing that, really elevating that conversation to our forefront. It's for those of us that are practitioners in this world every single day, it's good for us to be reminded, hey, not just can we do something, but should we do something, like you said. And you just mentioned, you know, just pausing, stopping, and taking time to read a book. Do you have, you've already recommended several books and several resources during our time together. Is there a book that you've been reading recently that has been helpful to you that you can recommend to our audience?
Yeah, I would say there's two, and they're probably not exactly what you'd be thinking of when in terms of like book recommendations. One is a book, and it's funny because I think often when we think about ethics, we often don't think about what the Old Testament teaches us about ethics. Often we think, well, the Old Testament's the Old Testament. I really just need the New Testament. What does Jesus tell me to do? These are really good questions, and we need to be asking those as well. But when Jesus is talking about the sufficiency of God's word, he's actually addressing the Old Testament.
Yeah.
When Paul is talking about how all scripture is breathed by God and inspired by God and written by the Holy Spirit, or men written by men carried along by the Holy Spirit, he's actually talking about not only the New Testament, which is what he's writing, he's talking about the Old Testament.
Absolutely.
There's a really helpful book. It's a pretty long book, but honestly, it's by Christopher J.H. Wright, called Old Testament Ethics and the People of God. It's by IVP. It looks like it will be overwhelming, but one of the things that Dr. Wright does a really good job of is he doesn't cloak everything in super academic language. It is more of an academic book. It's going to press people. It challenges you, it challenged me, but it was just a really helpful overview. And he wrote it to say, like, I want normal people without theological education to be able to pick up this book and read it. And so it'll probably take you a while to get through, and that's okay. Or maybe you have a certain question, or maybe you've always been wondering about how this Old Testament law or this Old Testament principle applies today. That's something that Dr. Wright does a really good job in service to the church. It's called Old Testament Ethics for the People of God. Absolutely. I really have enjoyed that book. There's also a book that's probably a lot more practical than that, that I think would be really helpful. And it actually just came out early this year by Brett McCracken. It's called The Wisdom Pyramid by Crossway. Brett McCracken, he's a senior editor of the Gospel Coalition. He's written on technology, kind of culture and the arts for a number of years. A really, really talented author. The book is just a really helpful kind of practical guide about levels of wisdom in our society, of starting with God's word, letting that be the foundation, moving up to the church, kind of the church, the traditions of the church, but also the centrality of our local church, of learning and wisdom and how we gain wisdom from that, moving up to seeing how God's created nature to work and understanding even slowing down in a society that, as I said, has kind of prioritizes speed and efficiency of slowing down and seeing the way the world works around us. And then getting into issues of the art and even social media, he does kind of a food pyramid of how he approaches the pursuit of wisdom, that we need more Bible and less social media. We need more church and less arts. And so it's kind of that, not that it's a specific of how many hours or how many food, you know, servings you need of X, Y, and Z, but it's kind of a helpful approach to thinking through wisdom in the digital age. I really benefited. I had him on my podcast, the Weekly Tech Podcast, just a few weeks ago, talking about his new book, The Wisdom Pyramids. That'd be a really helpful book. Probably those would be the two right off the top of my head that I'd recommend.
Oh, that's fantastic. So how can a person connect with you? You mentioned that you have a podcast, the Weekly Tech Podcast. Yeah. How can a person find that? And also, how can a person get a hold of your book, your books, The Age of AI, which I would recommend everybody, every single one of our listeners, get a hold of that. I know I have benefited from it. And so and if they want to contact you directly, how's the best way for audience to get a hold of you?
Yeah, the easiest way is to go to jasonthacker.com. At my website, I have a podcast listed there. We have the Weekly Tech newsletter. So we have the Weekly Tech podcast where I interview kind of a leading thinker or scholar or author about their work and how that applies in technology and ethics. But then also we have the website full of articles, a lot of things like is marketing moral or book recommendations, all of that kind of stuff is on jasonthacker.com. As well as the Weekly Tech newsletter, which comes out each Monday morning with a big story or article for the week, and then a number of related tech stories that you should be aware of as you kind of prepare for the week ahead, along with a book recommendation each week. So that's a really helpful resource delivered to your box every Monday morning at 6 a.m. Again, you can just go to jasonthacker.com. You can see the newsletter, the podcast, the articles, and there's also a way to contact me. And then, yeah, you can grab my book, The Age of AI, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity from Zondervan. You can grab it at your favorite retailer. I love local bookstores. So if you're able to go out into a local bookstore and pick it up, snap a picture of it, put it online, let me know where it is so I can see. But then also you can grab those on Amazon and a number of other major retailers, The Age of AI.
Excellent. Jason, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your insights.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Chad.